We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of focus, we'll be talking about China. The Chinese economy is the world's second largest. That puts China in direct competition with the United States, which at the moment holds the top spot. At the same time, China and the United States say that they want to be partners on the international stage in East Asia and generally in the world. And perhaps one might ask the question, well, is it possible for two countries like this to be both partners and competitors? In this hour of focus, we'll be talking with someone who has been a China watcher for quite a long time. His name is David Lampton. He's director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Before going there, he served as president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations in New York City. He was also affiliated with the Nixon Center as the founding director of its Chinese Studies program. And before 1988, he was the founding director of the China Policy Program at the American Enterprise Institute. And he was associate professor of political science at Ohio State. He is the author of a number of books and articles on Chinese domestic and foreign affairs. His writing has appeared in a number of places, Foreign Policy, New York Times, Washington Post, Christian Science Monitor. He's been widely interviewed, and his most recent book is The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. It was published in 2008 by the University of California Press. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. You may call. The number is 333-9455. That's the number to use if you're in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And you can email if you'd like to do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you'd like to talk with us, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. And Professor Lampton, hello.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. And I understand you were just in China within the last, I don't know, month or something?
Yes. I spent about 2 weeks in Shanghai, Nanjing, and Beijing, and then went on to Seoul, Korea, where the nuclear problem was much under discussion.
Mm-hmm. And the first time you went to China was 1976, is that right?
Yes, I've always thought we were the first American group in. It was a group of steroid chemists, and I accompanied them as a young assistant professor of China studies to interpret China to them. And Mao had just died, and they had 30 days of morning, and then opened up, and we were on the first plane in from Tehran.
Mm. So you've been watching China and going there for some time now.
I have.
This is a very interesting and complex relationship, and I hope that you wouldn't object too much the way that I set things up for our jumping-off point, because it does seem that in many respects what the two countries are trying to do here is to balance both the drive to compete, certainly in the economic sphere, if not political, but also the impulse to want to cooperate and have positive relations. Is it difficult, do you think, for the two countries to juggle those two things?
Well, I think you sort of set the intellectual table very well, and that indeed is the challenge. If you think about most of the problems both the United States faces in the world and the problems the world faces, of course, with China being 20% of the world's people, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to manage problems like viral disease, global climate change, proliferation, and so forth. So we really desperately need to cooperate, and the Chinese recognize this. On the other hand, the United States now, as you mentioned in the setup, in terms of economic challenge, is facing a great challenge not only from China, but places like Brazil and and India and so forth, and particularly with a global downturn and the problems our manufacturing sector has had and the dynamism that we see in China, sets up an economic competition and fosters protectionist impulses, I should say, not only in the U.S., but in China and elsewhere as well. And so we have this very sort of sweet and sour mix of a competition on the one hand, but we need to keep it in that competition and friction in balance or in some reasonable relationship, because we also have equally compelling needs for cooperation. And so I think this administration, the last administration under George W. Bush, faced this need to balance and, frankly, will face this need for as far as the eye can see.
Something that strikes me, and I think this is true, and you can tell me whether or not that it is, it seems that really that U.S.-China policy has not changed very much since Nixon. And to say that, it seems to me that's quite a statement, because we're talking about 30 years, several administrations, both Democratic and Republican administrations. Assuming that I'm correct, how does one think about that?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very perceptive observation that indeed, in one very fundamental way, our policy hasn't changed much from Nixon. And I guess we had to put a contemporary label on that policy. It's engagement. And engagement meaning we need to keep talking to the Chinese no matter how frustrated we get with them, or incidentally, how frustrated they get with us on certain issues, that we really don't have any choice but to work through these issues, and sometimes that involves compromise. We're not going to get everything we want out of the Chinese, and let me assure you and your audience, the Chinese don't get everything they want out of us. But from Nixon on, that's been basically the presumption. Now, for President Nixon, that was based on our common, meaning China and the United States, opposing the Soviet Union. And so in the service of that strategic cooperation, we downplayed a lot of issues in the relationship. Human rights issues might be among them, economic frictions, and so forth. Later, after the Soviet Union fell, the compelling need to cooperate now is not quite as clear and maybe even as compelling in some way as the anti-Soviet rationale. But now the rationale is really, China's our most rapidly growing export market and has been for a number of years, even though we also have a huge trade deficit with China. So economic cooperation has been a very relatively new and compelling dimension of the relationship, and also the need for transnational cooperation on things like global warming and proliferation and so forth. So the specific rationale for engaging China and putting up with all the frustrations we both feel with each other has shifted over time, but the underlying logic is that China just occupies too big a strategic space in the world, has too big a population, has too dynamic a population to be ignored. And so while the specific rationale for U.S.-China relations will change over time, I think we are locked into this notion, and indeed appropriately so, that we really don't have a choice but to try and make this work, however frustrating and limited our achievements may seem to be.
Our guest in this hour of focus is David Lampson. He's director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and has been following China and Chinese politics for quite a long time now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just recently, last month, not very long ago, the president of China, Hu Jintao, was here in the United States. He's visiting Washington, was received at the White House. He also was in Chicago and made for wonderful photo opportunities, certainly, particularly the visit to Washington and the state dinner with the president, President Obama. At the same time, one wonders at this level, I'm sure that it's a good thing for leaders of countries like China and the United States to have some personal contact. But you also have to wonder, as I think many people wrote about this summit, does that really mean anything? What exactly is achieved by events like this?
Well, I think you're right. If you ask what did Hu Jintao want out of this visit, I think he's retreating towards the sidelines of succession and wants to leave a legacy, and among that legacy wants to leave passably good relations with the United States. And therefore, in a sense, what he wanted was some nice pictures and friendly video to beam back to his people that would further legitimate his efforts and legitimate his rule as he fades off into the political sunset. So I think he had a very symbolic objective, and to that degree, that's frustrating to Americans because we're more results-oriented. So if you ask from the American point of view, what did they get? I guess you would say it was limited but not unimportant. First of all, I was very glad he went to Chicago and the middle part of our country. I think it's very important that the Chinese understand the views of not just the East Coast capital city and New York City, which is what they always concentrate on, but that they have a broader vision of our country and try to communicate with our people. So I take the Chicago part of the visit actually to be, in some sense, the most important in terms of long-range mutual understanding. And he visited some small plants in the area where the Chinese are beginning to create employment and so on. So I thought actually the Chicago portion to me was in the long run the most important part. But if you look at more specific results of the trip, first of all, there were about $40+ billion worth of deals signed, aircraft and so forth. Now, most of those would have been signed whether he came or not, and they sort of stacked up the things to be signed so he'd have something to do. But there was an economic benefit to this. Secondly, China's moving to a new generation of leaders, and they agreed that they presumptive next leader of China will come to the United States in the next year or so. I think that's very important to create a kind of interpersonal knowledge between leaders at the higher level. So I think it was important, and Vice President Biden will go to China, so I think that was worth doing. Another thing is Americans have been worried about whether China accepts the presence of the United States in Asia as an Asia-Pacific power. And in the joint statement that was issued on January 19th by the two presidents, China clearly recognized the United States as an Asia-Pacific power and accepted the fact it was going to have to deal with us. Now, implicitly in the past, China's recognized that, but it was a very clear statement, and I think that's somewhat reassuring. We also have military-to-military exchanges back on track. About a year ago, the Chinese terminated a lot of the exchanges between our two militaries. There's extreme, well, I would say mounting distrust in both militaries of each other. And so if we can get our militaries talking to each other, I think that's a net plus, and that got pushed forward. So I wouldn't want to say anything happened here that's going to change the world, but it was worth doing. Maybe the most significant thing was on North Korea. The Chinese were more critical of North Korea after the sinking of the ship in March of last year, and then the island barrage in November. The Chinese had withheld criticism of North Korea, and in the joint statement issued by our two presidents during the summit, the Chinese went some distance to criticizing the North and putting some pressure on them. So probably North Korea was the single most important, but it was a baby step. I wouldn't say it's a great leap forward.
Well, that maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that for a moment or two, because when you read about North Korea and the concerns that the United States has and other nations have about North Korea, and particularly its efforts to build nuclear weapons, the thing that you always see is that among all the nations, the one nation that is said to have any sort of influence at all over the government of North Korea is China. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, though, I think that some people have said, that's true, that one shouldn't overstate just how much influence the Chinese have over the North Koreans. So then the question is, well, truly, how much influence does China have over North Korea?
Well, what we don't know about North Korea and North Korea-China relations would fill books. So everybody is very rapidly going to be speculating. I would fall more into the category of the second group of people. Yes, China has more leverage than anybody else, but nobody has very much leverage. It's true that China exports probably to North Koreans on somewhat concessional terms, maybe half of its energy and half or more of its food. And we would think, of course, that that gives China tremendous leverage. But as Chinese person once put it to me, you know, you have to give somebody something before you can take it away. And the Chinese, in the case of food and energy, if they were to really bring the hammer down on those two fronts, then they have to ask themselves, where are all these starving or malnourished and under-heated people going to go? And the answer is towards China and towards China's northeast provinces that already have hundreds of thousands of North Korean emigres in that area. And these northeast provinces themselves have very high unemployment. China really doesn't need more unemployed and, in the case of North Koreans, not educated people for the modern world. And so China really doesn't want, its first priority isn't denuclearization or nonproliferation. China's first priority is to keep a somewhat stable regime in North Korea. Also, quite frankly, the Chinese, I think, believe that by having a North Korean problem sort of festering, the U.S. has to keep coming and asking for China's help, and that restrains the United States in other areas of its relationship with China. It might be human rights, it might be Taiwan, and so on. So the Chinese think they get some leverage over us by having this this problem. Also, that, quite frankly, why the Chinese say they want a reunified South and North Korea, they really don't. And they would rather see the Korean Peninsula divided into two relatively weaker states. And if there was a reunification, it would be probably under South Korea, almost certainly. And that means there would be a united Korea allied with the United States right up on China's border. So the Chinese feel comfortable with a buffer zone there. So while the Chinese don't want a nuclear North Korea and they don't want Kim Jong-il and the North Korean regime causing provocations that could lead to war, they will exercise some restraint over North Korea, but it's limited. And ultimately, China's major goal, I think, is to keep a stable, probably divided Korea.
There is this plan, I believe this year, for there to be an exchange of vice presidents. That is, Vice President Biden will be going to China, and the vice president of China, a man named Xi Jinping, will be coming here. And I think that this man, Mr. Xi, right, is expected, I think widely expected, to be the next president, to take over from President Hu.
Right.
What can you say about Xi Jinping and what sort of person he is?
Well, Americans have on occasion met him, but he hasn't had extensive exposure abroad, and not a lot of Americans have met him. And, of course, leaders, even when you meet them, don't necessarily reveal a lot about themselves. So there's a lot we do need to know, and that's why I said earlier I thought it was important that in the next year or so he will be coming here. We'll, I think, learn a lot more. But we do know quite a bit about him. First of all, he's the son of a famous revolutionary that was close to Deng Xiaoping. And he has worked, unlike the current president, he has some military, albeit limited military, experience. My own hope, therefore, is that he will be able to maybe exert a little more control in the military than the current president has. And if I had, you know, one criticism one could have of the current president of China, Hu Jintao, is that his roots in the military are practically non-existent, and therefore he's had to be deferential to the military a way his predecessors did not have to be. So we ought to keep a careful eye on how he uses his military experience. Even more relevant to Americans, he's been the provincial leader in two of China's well, really three of China's most export-oriented, outward-looking, globalized provinces, Fujian province, Zhejiang province, and Shanghai for a brief period of time. And so he's been on the vanguard of opening Chinese economy up. And in the most trading-minded, commercially-minded, cosmopolitan dimensions of Chinese society. So I think there's every reason to think he will continue the outward-oriented policy. He's also traveled a bit and on occasion has been asked what you might call, from his point of view, provocative questions, and he bites right back. He argues and he makes so he's a quite straightforward person. Hu Jintao, the current president, everyone sort of wonders, well, what's really on his mind? He's a very close-to-your-vest kind of guy. I think the next guy is going to be much more at least open and transparent in what he thinks. We won't always like what he thinks, but at least we'll be have a clearer idea what it is. So, you have to say, on the one hand, you just don't know what environment these people are going to be in. You don't know who they're going to be surrounded by. You don't really know that much about their value system. But at this limited stage of knowledge that we're at right now, I'm hopeful that he'll be at least as good, if not better, than the current leadership.
We're about midway through this hour of Focus. Our guest is David Lampton, someone who has been studying China for quite a long time now. He's director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's also served as president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations in New York City. He was affiliated with the Nixon Center as the founding director of its Chinese Studies program. Before that, he was founding director of the China Policy Program at the American Enterprise Institute. He was also associate professor of political science at Ohio State. His writing has appeared in many publications. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent is titled The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. It was published in 2008 by University of California Press. And also apparently has been published in China as well. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that's interesting because a number of years ago, a long time ago, I was very interested in Japan, and one of the things about the Japanese is they were avid consumers of books about them, written by non-Japanese.
Right.
And so they were always very eager when something was written by an American academic or journalist or foreign policy person to get that translated into Japanese so that people could read it, because they were very interested in how they were viewed by the rest of the world. What do people in China think about Three Faces of Chinese Power?
Well, I haven't seen any what you might call reviews, but the people who have read it, and I was struck as you're talking about the Japanese desire to read what foreigners think about them. China has an equal compulsion. If you really ask, and I think it fits into the larger motif of modern Chinese history, and that is the Chinese prior to 1840 thought of themselves as a great center of the cultured world and major influence in the world. And then in 1840, with the rise of imperialism and the dynamic Western industrial militaries and industry and colonialism and so on, fell into 150 years of bad time from their point of view. And now, since 78 and the opening and reform and so on, China's regaining market share and regaining its place in the world. And a major impulse of the Chinese has been to regain their status in the world, their sense of equality, if not superiority. And so when they look at what the rest of the world is saying about them, this becomes a major indicator of their own success.
Just to talk a little bit about some of the themes that you deal with in the book, I'm sure that there are people who are concerned with Chinese military power. But you make this argument, and I think it's an interesting one that puts this in some perspective, that as China has thought about what kind of military it needs, that they really understood, I think the argument you make is that the Chinese observed and understood the mistake the Soviet Union made and decided they would not repeat it.
So
it's not that they don't have a military or that they don't think that it's important, but they I think they have been careful about how much they put into in the way of resources. It doesn't mean that their neighbors don't worry about China, because of course they do. But what can one say about how China thinks about military power, and not just sort of what they need, but how they would be willing to exercise that power?
Well, you gave a very nice summary, and it's accurate, and I won't repeat it. But I think the in terms of the military, the Chinese, their views probably change over time a bit. And certainly the first 30 years of reform, roughly from 1978 to the last few years, the military was put in a very subordinate position for the most part in allocation of budget and so forth. The idea was you couldn't have a modern military without having a modern economy, modern society, highly educated people. And so if you kept in the short run dumping money into the military, you wouldn't have the foundation on which a modern military is really required. And I think that, along with the Soviet Union's example of spending so much on the military that you had a society deeply frustrated because there was nothing to consume, and that military power of the Soviet Union created enemies all over the world that then built alliances that forced the Soviets to spend more money, which deepened their internal problems. So I think the Chinese look at all that, and they want to keep the military expenditure and its posture in the world and not make the mistake that the Soviets made, either with over-allocation of resources or too threatening to the outside world. But I did say things change, and you know, as people get more resources, as they get more interest in the world, I mean, for the beginning of the reform period, China had very few interests in the Middle East because it imported virtually no oil from the Middle East. Now it imports perhaps 50% of its oil consumed is imported, and probably 80%+ of that comes from the Middle East. So now suddenly with globalization and industrialization and consumers that are buying cars, China has interests much further from its shores than it ever did before, and it's consequently building a navy and an air force, and before long you're going to be reading about aircraft carriers and so forth. And so while I think that general strategic framework of not overemphasizing the military, trying to be reassuring, not over-allocating, as China's getting more interest in the world, it is building a bigger and bigger military. And also it's adopting new technology. So not long ago it tested an anti-ballistic missile at the beginning of 2010. In 2007, it shot a satellite out of the sky. You just read just before President Hu came here, there's at least an alleged test of a stealth fighter aircraft of some description. So, you know, technology carries us forward. China's increasing interest in the world rationalized the need for a more capable military, and China's economy is able to sustain a more robust military. So, yes, I think the Chinese have been very intelligent to increase their power overall, economic, intellectual, and military power, without creating a great sense of threat. But in the last couple of years, I would say that perception of threat of China's neighbors, and particularly in the last year, China's foreign policy has not been very skillful in my estimation. And the level of threat has taken a kind of, I would think from the Chinese point of view, an alarming step up, whether it's the Republic of Korea getting closer to the U.S., Japan getting closer, Vietnam, India, and so on. So I think the Chinese have to reassess what they're doing and see how they can once again become more reassuring.
All right. We have a caller in Eureka to talk with. Let's do that. Line four. Hello.
Good evening. Very interesting discussion. Your last sentence is sort of touched on my question. That is on the, I believe it was a Charlie Rose program. One scholar of China was saying exactly that same thing, that many of China's neighbors were feeling threatened by its increasing aggressiveness, pomposity maybe, and I guess the aircraft carrier too. I've heard certain persons who I talk to about international affairs become worried about China building up its military. Could you specifically talk a little bit more in detail about India? And I have heard, too, that that one scholar was specially noted how India was approaching getting closer to the United States because of increasing preoccupation with the threat of China militarily.
Well, there are a lot of questions buried there, but the core one is India. And I guess I would say when China's neighbors, and India is just the biggest case of a Chinese neighbor, but Vietnam would fall into this, Singapore, Indonesia. I think they all are very conflicted when they think about China. On the one hand, economically, China is becoming a more important export market for everybody in Asia, maybe less so India. But certainly the other smaller states, China is probably their major export market and probably their most rapidly growing export market. And India has lots of hopes to be able to develop its domestic industry and to export to China and so forth, although it has a lot of trade frictions with China. On the one hand, all of China's neighbors see this great economic opportunity, and they don't want to mess that up. They also have some economic frictions with China. But on the other hand, they see China growing in military power, and China does have expansive claims in the South China Sea that extend almost all the way down to Indonesia. And, you know, that's about a 6-7 hour flight from the southern borders of China. So you're talking about absolutely enormous claims in potentially resource-rich areas that are under dispute by at least six nations in the region. So there's this growing military power, there are expansive claims, and of course with respect to India, there are two major territorial areas of territory under dispute. One is as big as Switzerland and one is as big as Taiwan. So these are, and they're strategically located areas in the Himalayas. And so that those disputes are important to both parties for strategic reasons. Further, India, I will just put it in the how I think the Chinese look at it. I'm not endorsing the view. The Dalai Lama has his capital of his society in Dharamsala in northern India. And, of course, it grates on the Chinese to have, in effect, a regime in exile from Tibet in northern India. Now, the Indians say and have said consistently since the 50s they don't recognize Tibet as an independent country. But the Chinese see this exiled government, and so on the one hand, India has a formally correct, from the Chinese point of view, policy, but on the other hand, they're providing safe haven to somebody they find working against the unity of China, is the way the Chinese would put it. So you have this strange relationship between India and China. The other thing is that, of course, they're both proud civilizations. Neither India or China are thought of, can be thought of just as a state. They are cultures. They are histories. They are worldviews. And so, in some sense, you know, as Chinese culture and the Chinese model grows in importance and salience in the world, this raises issues for the Indians about how they have to change, how they can promote their civilizational values and role. So you have a conflict not just of states but and economic interests and military interests, but these are each two proud civilizations, and that's a problem as well.
I want to, I don't know if the caller is still there, did we get at your question?
Could I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Could you, I'll take the answer off the air. Could you just discuss briefly the war they fought, I believe it was in 78 or 79, between China and Vietnam and the causes of that war? Thank you.
The Chinese refer to, they don't call it a war, they call it a defensive counterattack. But it's fairly described as a war. The United States and China had just normalized relations. This was in February 1979. Deng Xiaoping came to the United States after the normalization of relations. And in February of 1979, he told President Carter, then President Carter, that he was going to teach Vietnam a lesson. The reason Deng felt he wanted to teach Vietnam a lesson is, well, there had been some shelling and violence along their disputed border, Chinese villages getting hit. I'm sure the Vietnamese have their story about that as well. And then also in late 78, Vietnam had allied itself in an alliance with the Soviet Union and was getting ready to, well, was invading, going to invade, or was invading Cambodia. And so Deng, for all of these reasons, determined that when he came back from his visit to the United States, he was going to attack Vietnam to try to take the pressure off Cambodia and weaken the alliance between Vietnam and Moscow by showing Russia wouldn't do anything to help Vietnam, even if it was attacked by China, which was generally true. This military exercise in the early part of 1979 was a dramatic military, I would say, in a sense, defeat for the Chinese, in the sense that they lost a lot of troops. They showed how incapable their military was after the decade of the Cultural Revolution. So it was not a military success. In terms of the political objectives of showing that the Soviet Union really couldn't do much to help Vietnam and pulling some pressure off Cambodia by forcing the Vietnamese to move troops to their northern border, the political objective probably was partially achieved. But after this war, Deng became so convinced that his own military needed a reform that the years after that war, he cut the budget of the military dramatically, reduced the manpower from 4 million down to towards 2 million, and began the process of building the Air Force and the Navy and slimming down the Army. So that war with Vietnam was very important. Also, it emboldened critics of Deng Xiaoping in 1979, and you may remember Democracy Wall. And that, in part, got its energy from criticizing Deng in this war.
We are moving into about our last 15 minutes, and our guest is David Lampton. He's director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's the author of a number of books and articles on Chinese domestic and foreign affairs. His most recent book is The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. It's published by University of California Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. China in recent years has been moving in to gain influence, to win friends around the world in non-military means by investing a great deal, by doing humanitarian activities, by exchange programs that are cultural and otherwise, and using, generally speaking, what has come to be called as soft power. And in fact, a good deal has been written on this. All you have to do is do a Google search. If you do China and soft power, you're going to get a lot of hits. So this is something that people are definitely paying attention to. Maybe that's something you can also talk about what exactly China has been doing and how that's, as far as the Chinese are concerned, why they think that that's been good for China.
Well, that is, I think, maybe the key point in, or relates to the key point in my book, which is, if we look at the three forms of power, we'll call coercive military power, economic power, the capacity to buy or bribe, and then intellectual power, the capacity to persuade. I think the core argument, at least for my book, for the last 30 years, is China actually has put its emphasis on the minds and the persuasion, on the intellectual and the economic. So it's not been the might that's been emphasized as much as it's been the minds and the economic dimension. And I think this has an implication for the United States. If we react to China's challenge such as it is in the military domain, I think we'll be underinvesting in the economic competitive domain and the intellectual domain, where I think the Chinese have really put their effort. Now, that doesn't mean that that will always be true, but I think it is true, and that we should see China as an intellectual and economic challenge more than a military challenge. why we, of course, need to stay attuned to that. Now, that gets us to soft power in your question, and that is, I think, as I said, the Chinese have tried to be reassuring. As their power grows, they've wanted to try to reassure the world. Now, the last year, they haven't been very successful at that, and a lot of us are debating why. Why are the Chinese changing a successful policy here? Or are they changing it, or is it just a temporary fluctuation? But in any case, the Chinese have been trying to increase their soft power in a number of ways. And by soft power, also, I would say their own intellectual capability. First of all, there are about 120,000 students and scholars in the, or students in the United States from China. At any given time, higher education is a huge export for the United States, and the Chinese are a very big part of that. So they're trying to boost their knowledge and capacity to understand and communicate with the United States. And you find Chinese scholars are working for Time Warner and all sorts of they send students to schools such as my own to learn how to have the vocabulary to communicate, not only in English, but in conceptually communicate, understand the world as we see it. So a huge part of this has been their attempt to speak our language, not only literally, but figuratively. Secondly, China's becoming a major aid donor, particularly in Africa. And that's not an inconsiderable part of this soft power. And China puts a lot fewer restrictions on its aid and gets some criticism for doing that. It doesn't have what you might call very high human rights standards. It doesn't necessarily have high standards in the anti-corruption area. So there's a lot to be said about China's foreign aid. But you know, Africa really wasn't on the intellectual map of the West until China showed a lot of interest, and suddenly we're all interested in it. So aid is part of this. China is also trying to support the learning of Chinese language all over the world. It feels that English is, you know, by virtue, I suppose you would say, of the British Empire, if nothing else, made English the lingua franca of much of the world. And China realizes that if it could increase the cultural understanding of China, plus make Chinese a more universally used language, it would have great power. It's setting up Confucius Institutes in, I don't know, 300 or 400 universities and institutions around the world. Just as an example, the Chinese have given money and teachers to the city school system in Chicago to institute Chinese language programs. They helped the Educational Testing Service develop and help pay for a development of an advanced placement test in Chinese. So the Chinese are putting a lot of emphasis into that. Even military exchanges, we think of military as hard power, but if you have a tsunami or an earthquake and the U.S. aircraft carrier, the George Washington, or the hospital ship Hope shows up off your shores, that's not hard power, that's soft power. And the Chinese are beginning to think about using their military. They've just developed a hospital ship, and you'll see that now in ports of call throughout Asia, I'm sure. So, you know, the Chinese will see how much they do, how effective it is. They're also, I remember meeting with President Jiang Zemin at one point in a group, and he said, you know, you Americans talk about democracy, but it really isn't democracy in the world because you control the global airwaves through CNN. You get your story out. You get your framework put on everything. Well, we're going to develop global communications, and we're going to reach the world, and we're going to tell our story in our way on our time. And they are developing global satellite communications, global television cable channels, and so on. So they're moving ahead.
We have, again, maybe about 5 minutes left. We have a caller here, and we'll go to them. Champaign County, line one. Hello?
Hi. I haven't been listening. I've been listening to the Egypt situation. But you just mentioned the aircraft carriers. Well, the U.S. is the one that sends the super carrier into the Yellow Sea for maneuvers with the South Koreans, and they've done these military maneuvers regularly for ever since the war didn't end. It just seems to me that that can be, and I've said it here on the radio a lot, it's quite belligerent in a way, and refusing to negotiate. So that's just one thing. North Korea is a buffer state, problematic to the Koreans themselves. But a lot was made out of Gates' trip to China and the testing of this stealth plane at the same time. And my memory is that he actually mentioned the stealth plane on the way over and was saying that it wasn't going to be ready for 2 years or so, according to their calculations. It was sort of a challenge, and there was a lot of consternation about whether who did decide to do this or not. It just seems to me that there's a complexity there that that we don't hear on CNN, and right. We don't hear it much on public radio here either. No one actually brings that up on a regular basis. The fact that if we want the Chinese to not be belligerent,
right,
we might not want to have military maneuvers in their backyard. That would be like them doing it in the Caribbean, right?
Right. Well, I would align myself with the sentiment there that I think we need as much insight into how what we do and what we say plays in China and how Chinese people or people of other countries look at it, as well as a clear concept of our own interests and our own desires. And so I'm sympathetic to what you said on both counts, but I think it deserves a little elaboration. The Yellow Sea is a complicated issue, and there's an overall issue, and that is historically there's been the 12-mile limit, and beyond the 12-mile limit, ships have been entitled to go without reference to the coastal power, as long as it's innocent, meaning not warlike, passage. The Chinese, but there's a countervailing concept, and that is the 200-mile special or exclusive economic zone. And what the Chinese have tried to do is move that their control of passage from that 12-mile limit essentially out to the 200-mile limit. No naval power, not just the U.S., but or maritime power, have to seek approval for passage out to 200 miles. And so the continual battle we've had with the Chinese is what activities can go on in that space between 12 and 200 miles. And the U.S. is afraid to agree to any principle other than the traditional 12-mile limit. So this thing in the Yellow Sea partly is a function of that. Now, you're right, the Yellow Sea is not a huge mass of water, but it's pretty big. The U.S., when the Chinese say, do not send your ship into the Yellow Sea, of course, this gets translated in the American mind and in the Navy as, if we abide by that Chinese request, are we reinforcing their claim out to 200 miles, which we don't want to do, not only with respect to China, but nobody else. And so in a kind of awkward way, the more the Chinese push their point of view, the more we have to resist it. Also, in the case of specifically the Yellow Sea, you had the North Korean barrage on the island and the earlier sinking, and the United States wanted to make sure that North Korea did not misunderstand our restraint as weakness. And so we, along with the South Koreans, wanted to reinforce deterrence, and that is we wanted them to see what power we could bring to bear. And so we saw this not as aimed at China, but in fact to reinforce deterrence with North Korea. This is part of what I meant by China's lack of skillful diplomacy. I think in this case, China would have been better to say it understood the desires of the Koreans and the Americans to deter North Korea. They were not going to object. Instead, they decided to see it as a challenge to their own power and directed at China. And it wasn't directed at China. I think they made a mistake by framing that way. But in any case, this whole sea thing relates to what activities can go on out to 200 miles. So this is a difficult problem. Now, with respect to Secretary Gates, I did note when he was on the airplane heading towards China, he had some statements. I said, boy, the Chinese aren't going to like this. And that raises the issue, did they decide to test this to sort of put him on notice that they were going to, they had their own capabilities and were going to go on their own calendar, irrespective of what he liked. I don't know the dynamics. It's entirely possible, in my view, that they tested this plane. It had been under development. I'm not sure the Supreme Leader of China weighs in on every test. And the military may have taken this action to sort of needle the U.S. Defense Department without the top leader being fully aware of what was going to happen when. My guess is Hu Jintao did not look did not like looking like he didn't know what was going on, which to me suggests he might not have known what was going on.
Real quick, it seems that the government of China continues to be very concerned about trying to muffle internal dissent. There is something the United States has long complained about. Just the most recent illustration, apparently, is the two of the biggest Internet portals in China were blocking Internet searches with the keyword Egypt.
Right.
So they didn't want people to reading about what was going on in Egypt. Is that something that's likely to change?
I would say not. Not until, there's a fundamental reassessment of the role that political reform needs to play in China. China, unfortunately, in my view, has been pretty successful on, Internet management. We'll put it that way. Not totally successful, but from their point of view, somewhat successful. And China's leaders see themselves sitting on a social volcano. And a few years back, you had all the color revolutions in Central Asia, and now you've got Tunisia, now Middle East, and people are talking about Jordan. I think this all scares the Chinese leadership very substantially, and their internet management is just an example a manifestation of that anxiety and concern.
Well, there, I think that we must finish again with our thanks to our guest, David Lampton. He's director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's written many books and articles on Chinese domestic and foreign affairs. His most recent book is The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds, published in 2008 by the University of California Press. And Professor Lampton, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.